Greetings and welcome to Throttle Up. This is a radio show and podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And it is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, all aboard the Throttle Up Express, powered by High Velocity Reason, and I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. Now, I'm a naval aviator and former squadron commander and Top Gun instructor as a naval aviator. And also, I'm a pioneer in the field of some aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving, and of course, high velocity reason. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary. So we could say that we are not ordinary thinkers, you and I, but we are different and we are out of the box thinkers. Our motto for the show is to employ high velocity reason to achieve high octane performance. And in a nutshell, that basically means to stay out ahead of the problem. That's particularly important if we want to achieve success. Now, our mission statement for the show, and this changes a little bit from time to time, but this is a pretty good mission statement, is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Now, our website, the address here is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. That's the address for the website. And before we close on our introduction, I wanted to say that our audio engineering services is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, which is right outside of Denver on the west side. Highly recommend their services for anyone who wants to get involved with audio. It could be any kind of audio that you might have in mind, including music, by the way. Also, graphics artist services and media support is provided by Reflections Printing, and the gal is Jennifer. She heads up this organization, and she owns it as well. And Jennifer does a great job with all of our media support, is a fantastic graphics artist and media production specialist, and her phone number is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. And before we close the introduction, I want to say that the show is typically organized into three parts. So part one of Throttle Up is critical thinking, or an ongoing discussion of various aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving. Part two is our storyboard, and the storyboard is a story of America, or a story of Americans, story of an individual. It could be any kind of story, but it all relates to trying to get our arms around this whole thing, which we call critical thinking and complex problem solving. And then part three is our radio essay. Now, our radio essay is typically a little bit more in-depth treatment of a particular subject. We do not intend for this to be boring. But for those who would like a little bit more info on certain things that we cover in part one and part two, then part three typically is a way for us to get a little bit further into a subject matter and understand it better. Okay, all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critical thinkers and complex problem solvers are welcome with open arms. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. Now, before we get into our regular show, as you know, our regular show is organized typically into three parts. Part one is, of course, our continuing discussion of critical thinking and complex problem solving. And then part two is the storyboard. And then I'll follow it up by the radio essay if we have time. But, you know, something happened this week, and it's it's top of the news. I wanted to address it because it has some, you know, serious meanings across the board, not only for this show, but for all of us as Americans, for all of us as participants in this world of ours. And that's the Trump-Kim summit that just happened. And now, I guess it was Tuesday. So it just happened on Tuesday. Tuesday, Singapore time was actually, I think it was Monday evening this time. Anyway, so we'll talk about that in some fashion to try to understand it. I know that most of you are reading stuff about it and considering it and what effect it will have on America, what effect will have on global politics. So we'll talk about that. Before we do, I wanted to pass along a kind of a special announcement. We have, and I mentioned this last week, we have increased our footprint or the number of times that we are on Red State Talk Radio on the weekends. So our weekend exposure has increased, and we are delighted and thankful for Red State Talk Radio for making this happen, making all these additional times available. So all of us on this side of the microphone and the team that supports me, quite a few people, are quite delighted and pretty excited. We're excited about our increased exposure. We're excited about the show. And also the podcast. The podcast is up and running. You can find it on iTunes right now. It should be available on other platforms, but we know it's available now on iTunes. And so if you go to iTunes, you can just type in Throttle Up or Throttle Up Radio. I think either one works. And so to be safe, type in Throttle Up Radio. And there you can find all of the podcasts that we have available. And there are a number of them, including the latest one. So Throttle Up is now on demand. We're pretty excited about that also. So we have not only on demand, but we have increased exposure on the weekends. And by the way, Throttle Up is available now on the main channel on Saturdays at 6 a.m., also at 8 p.m. and at 12 midnight. And Sundays at 6 a.m. Now, that's the main channel. Also, we continue to be available on the Encore channel, and that's at 6 p.m. both Saturdays and Sundays. And all these times are Eastern. Again, these are Eastern times for the main channel and for the Encore channel. So let's see. We are 1, 2, 3, 4. We are on 6 times every weekend on both channels on Red State Talk Radio. So we're pretty excited about that. All right. So I want to say a few things and discuss a few things and read a few things about this recent summit, this Trump-Kim summit that just occurred in Singapore. So before we get into some of the things I wanted to read about other observers, I wanted to give you my take on it. This is my particular take on this rather historic event, what it means, why did it happen, and what should we look for going forward, and what's the potential for it to be, whatever we're trying to do, for it to be ultimately successful. So I guess you could say, well, Kevin, you need to, what's the mission statement here? All right. And I would agree with that. What is our mission statement from the point of view of America? And the mission statement might contain things like, you know, world peace, reduce the exposure to the devastation of nuclear weapons and stuff like that. All right. So, and you can, I probably should have written my mission statement or what I think it ought to be, but you can write your own and start from there. But, you know, the first thing that came to mind when I was listening to stuff and reading stuff about this summit, the first thing that came to mind is Singapore. All right. Now, why Singapore? Why hold it there? Is Singapore symbolic, or did it just happen to be available? Well, my view, and I think this is the view of others that I have listened to also, but my view is that Singapore is in fact symbolic, and it has been chosen for a very specific purpose. And those of you that have been there, I think can really appreciate what I'm about to say. So to start off, I would say that the first thing is that, yes, I have been to Singapore on a number of occasions, as it turns out, not just once. And most of these occasions were work-related. The first time I was in Singapore, I was in the Navy, deployed on an aircraft carrier. The carrier happened to be the USS Constellation, and I was a squadron commander of one of the squadrons on board that supercarrier. And one of the ports of call we made when I was deployed to the Pacific was Singapore. It's kind of unusual because we were the first carrier ever to do so, but it was kind of a big event, and there was a national news was aboard because this was kind of a big thing back then. This was in the late 1970s, so it was quite a while ago. But nevertheless, and it culminated in a big embassy party, which, of course, I was expected to attend as a squadron commander, and I did. But back then, and even up to the present time, because I was actually recently there a couple years ago, again on business, and Singapore is a hotbed of economic activity. Singapore is rather unusual because they are promoting this whole idea of prosperity for everybody, and they have gone to great lengths to ensure that prosperity for everyone is available. And they do it under the free market enterprise system. They promote and encourage businesses to relocate there, to start up firms, or to put your Asian division or Asian department there. And so they encourage businesses. They encourage the whole idea of entrepreneurship. And one of their big things that they talk about is best practices. What's the best practice in order to promote economic viability? And so they're really invested in that. So Singapore, I believe, was a very important place. It was a very important symbolic gesture by, I would say, probably, most assuredly, by the Trump administration. They were trying to surround themselves with this whole notion of economic prosperity. And as it turns out, for very good reason. And the reason for that is something that is not all that well known in media circles. And so I wanted to kind of use that as a springboard to my discussions about this summit. And this is kind of an interesting thing. I found it to be quite interesting as we consider what this summit means and what is its future to achieve some measure of success. Okay, so what is the primary purpose? The primary purpose, of course, is denuclearization of the area, or another way of saying that, of the Korean Peninsula, but certainly the area. We want to lower the threshold of devastating armed conflict, and so that was one of the main purposes. But there was another purpose too, which was related to that, which was improve the economic performance of North Korea, improve the livelihood of its people, because they're extremely poor, they can't feed themselves, there's a lot of malnutrition, and so forth and so on. So economic prosperity becomes the second main objective of, in my view, of this initiative. All right, so in the Wall Street Journal, again, I will use that as a source because I think it's a particularly good source. And this happens to be on Tuesday, June 12th. This was actually the day, or it was actually the day after, of course, because of the time difference between Singapore and the United States. Anyway, so this article was by Gerald F. Saib, and he goes on to say this. There's literally nothing in the history of the past three decades to suggest that the diplomatic dance President Donald Trump begins with North Korea on Tuesday will succeed. No hard evidence that North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons program. No record of North Korea honoring international agreements and so forth and so on. Okay, so he kind of starts off on a little bit of a negative note here. Okay, you can say that, well, he's being realistic. All right, I would not necessarily disagree with that. But he says that Mr. Trump, it should be President Trump, and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un sit down for a historic summit. The question is, why go ahead with this process at all? Okay, so he asked that question. He says the answer, say South Korean officials who have studied a speech given by Mr. Kim on April 20th to his Central Committee in North Korea. They studied his words closely, and they say that the young leader lays out the rationale for a profound strategic shift away from years of obsession with nuclear weapons and towards a plan to escape all-encompassing economic backwardness. That's what he says. Now, that's pretty interesting. So let me continue with that train of thought as I continue to read this a rather interesting article. He says that a huge dose of skepticism is needed here. All right. I would agree with that. I'm not quite as skeptical as he is, but nevertheless, he says that still it is important to look back closely at that April statement, for in many ways it offers the best explanation of why the U.S. and South Korea officials have decided the efforts of engagement in this particular initiative is worth the risks inherent in it. Mr. Kim's remarks that they were summarized in a dispatch by the Korean Central News Agency, the government mouthpiece. The agency reported that Mr. Kim told Central Committee members at the outset that he had convened them to decide important matters for attaining higher goals. The overall situation, he said, is rapidly changing. For the past several years, Mr. Kim said the North Korean people had worked hard with their belt tightened to acquire the powerful treasured sword of nuclear weapons. However, he goes on to say that having once done this, there's no longer any need to conduct nuclear tests and so forth. And we are finished with that endeavor. Instead, he said, North Korea now faces different important tasks. Specifically, he said, the strategic line of the ruling party henceforth would be to concentrate all efforts of the whole party and country to the socialist economic construction. Now, this article goes on to say that lest anybody missed the point, the report said, Mr. Kim suggested a new banner to mark the moment, one that proclaims, quote, let us further accelerate the advance of our revolution by concentrating all our efforts on socialist economic construction, end of quote. The article goes on to say that, in short, Mr. Kim was declaring a turn toward what he called a new strategic line. Economic development had become more important than further nuclear work. This article goes on to say there are, of course, several problems in deciding how much to read into those words. First, while Mr. Kim seems to be calling out a clear strategic shift, it isn't the first time such a thing has been suggested. The second problem is that even if the words mean exactly what they say, it isn't clear that a shift in emphasis from developing more nuclear arms also means willingness to give up nuclear arms already developed. Okay, well, it gets a little bit, that there, right there, it's a little, in my view, it's a little bit confusing there, and it's kind of missing the point here. Anyway, so let me continue with this article, because I think what the article is saying is that there may very well be a strong rationale to put nuclear weapons on the back burner, possibly give them up in some form or fashion, with the idea that that improving the economic condition of the people of North Korea is in fact the primary goal. This article goes on to say this: the Trump administration's long-term demand isn't merely that Mr. Kim stop his nuclear machine from moving forward, but that he throw it into reverse. Okay, yeah, that's true. He goes on to say, this article goes on to say, it remains hard to believe that Mr. Kim will do so. Okay. I would say that's not quite the way I would read it. Nevertheless, North Korea leaders educated in the West, he truly has a different view of the world and his country's place in it than did his father or grandfather. So, what do we make of this? The way I see it, using the perspective of critical thinking, is that something has changed. Something has changed in the in the equation that has been the reality of North Korea with respect to its neighbor, South Korea, as well as with respect to the rest of the world. Something has changed. I see it as a fundamental shift in strategy. I think there's been a significant change, and I would say that this the Trump-Kim summit is the first clear indication that something has changed dramatically and that we ought to consider it in terms of how we can best deal with this change, how we can capitalize on this strategic shift for good things, for a positive outcome, for not only for that particular country, but for the region and for the world. So that's my take on the Trump-Kim summit. I think that the higher goals and the new economic strategy is something that should give us some measure of confidence that maybe things will be different now. Maybe this is the start of something new. And, you know, the way I see it is that none of this stuff gets by Trump and his senior advisors. The way I see it is that they kind of knew this was happening anyway. They saw what was going on. They had boots on the ground, particularly in South Korea. And they observed something happening that did not was unexpected. And so they are, in fact, capitalizing on this this shift of attitude, capitalizing on the fact that maybe, just maybe, economic performance is now on the front burner with respect to North Korea and its ally China. And maybe there's something here that will benefit all of us. And so that's how I see it. That's how I read it. And I guess we'll see. I'm actually quite hopeful that we can turn a new chapter in this history and possibly have a better chance of being successful and bring prosperity to this region that desperately needs it. All right, so that completes this special talk about this recent summit. Now let's press on to part one. Okay, welcome back to part two. Throttle up for this week. Part two is our storyboard, and it is our discussion of, well, I guess you could say it's a continuing discussion of what we started off last week, and that is a jobs in America. What does this mean? And so we're going to be talking about this with respect to not only critical thinking, but we're going to be combining part one and part two together this week and talk about what's going on economically in this country? What does this jobs report mean? And how can we deal with it as a working people or as interested Americans in our economic performance? Now, you remember last week we talked about this jobs report and the fact that across the board, the jobs numbers have been quite impressive. Some of it is even unprecedented. And for example, now it's been reported that now there are more jobs available than people, or more jobs that are out there than there are people available to fill them. I think this is the first time in history that this is actually has happened. And so what I want to do then is kind of take a look at this thing from, well, I guess you could say from a little bit broader perspective, from perhaps a different perspective in terms of what is a job. What is a vocation? What is a passion? And sort of look at them in that context. Maybe we should not be talking about or thinking about jobs so much as what can I do that would be beneficial? What can I do with my life that would be productive, not only for myself, but for others? And I don't mean that in any sense except for the fact that we produce something of value as members of this great country and also as individuals. We produce something of value, and what is that we are doing? Is it we are holding a job, or are we being productive in working cooperatively with others in our organization to achieve some objective, to achieve some noble purpose, if you will, or to achieve something that is beneficial beyond ourselves and beneficial to others? So we might say, well, we are providing a product or a service, but sure, something that is of value to others, that are willing to exchange value for value. Okay, so the jobs report is particularly important. Now, I'm going to look at it a little bit differently, or from a little bit different perspective. I'm going to say, okay, so we have this economic engine that is in America, and it's going full bore, and it's producing all kinds of performance as well as all kinds of opportunities. More and more opportunities are cropping up. The thing I want to focus on is that as we consider our role in this country, what is actually going on? If we can kind of look beyond the jobs numbers and look beyond this narrow focus of jobs, if you will, or whatever, what is actually going on in this country? Well, what's going on, in my view, is a move toward innovation, is a move toward critical thinking and innovation in the workforce. And so that brings me to something I wanted to pass along, and I'm thinking of actually writing a blog posting for it and putting it on my website, and I probably will do that in the near future. But this is really fascinating, and I came across this study recently. This is a study, so a global study carried out by an organization in London, England, called MACAT, M-A-C-A-T, and you can locate them, MACAT.com, if you would like to. And they're an organization that supports critical thinking, and I think going to their website and learning about what they do or what they would like to do is good. So a global study carried out by MACAT in association with the University of Cambridge discovered that 84% of senior managers believed their organization suffered a loss due to an absence of critical thinking in the workforce. Concerns centered on a recurring failure of many employees to analyze data correctly due to a focus on specific job tasks rather than on higher order skills that could be universally applied to new and changing situations. So I would go on to say this in response to that statement. So the skills, and here I'm talking about this, the skills associated with this newness and change, this new and changing situation I call the skills associated with newness and change, need to be clarified and mastered. So we need to think in terms of being problem solvers first and foremost, instead of thinking of ourselves as fitting into a narrowly defined I would call it a pigeonhole. Are we pigeonholing people into these narrowly defined job descriptions, or are we saying we want you to, among other things, solve problems? We want you to identify problems and solve them, or we want you to be able to solve problems that are given to you, because we want, first and foremost, problem solvers in our organization. We want to be a solutions organization. And so your job description is either modified or it is changed completely in what you are being expected to do. Okay, so if that's our job in this new economic environment, if our job is to find solutions to complex problems, then what does that mean? And how should we consider such a thing going forward? How does this affect us, you and me, and how should we consider it? You notice I'm using the word how. How should we go about thinking about such a thing? Okay, the first thing I would just like to point out, and I know this is a little bit dry in its subject matter, but I will only spend a few moments on it, so bear with me. It's not going to hurt. I don't like these overly technical subjects and these dry subjects, but there are some things that we probably ought to understand going forward. When we say finding solutions to complex problems, what do we mean by that? And so I would list the following under the heading of characteristics of complex problems. What is the characteristics? All right, the first one is that problem contains large numbers of players. Or if you like the other word that's often used here, it's object. Objects or players means the same thing. And these are aspects of the problem that we can identify. They have defining characteristics, and there are lots of them. So there's lots of things going on. There's lots of moving parts. The second characteristic of a complex problem is it's dynamic in nature. That is, it is not static. It is dynamic. Everything is changing. Everything is moving. The third characteristic of a complex problem is that, and this may very well be the most important, is that it is difficult to initially clarify, or it is lots of fancy words that we can use. I'm not going to use all of the fancy words because I think it is hard to follow. I'm just going to say that it is difficult to clarify what is actually going on, and that requires a certain amount of skills, certain amount of insightfulness to be able to clarify what is actually going on in a complex problem. And the fourth thing to consider is that a complex problem usually contains multiple goals and objectives that are in play in order to solve it properly. So if we're dealing with complex problems, I guess the rule of thumb that I would offer is that if you attempt to apply a singular solution to a complex problem, it's almost certainly going to fail. So a singular solution to a complex problem is not the way to go. So you need to have a nonlinear solution needs to be developed. I guess you could say that. A nonlinear solution to a complex problem is, in fact, the way to go. All right, so in our discussion, there are two things that I think are very instructive, important, and kind of encouraging as we say, well, what is, how can I be a good problem solver? How can I be a solutions-based individual? And how is that possible? Because I'm not particularly good at solving problems, but I would say that that is, that's kind of a cop-out. I would say that we all have the potential to be innovative, to come up with innovative solutions to complex problems. We all have that potential. All it requires is a different perspective and to utilize different sets of tools that are available. They may not be all completely known, but the tool set is available. The innovative tool set is available. There's two stories that I wanted to pass along to you that gives you an idea of what we mean by complex problem solving and innovation and creativity as it applies to finding solutions to complex problems. The first story in our storyboard is the story of the P-51 during World War II. And we have talked about this before, but it deserves to be talked about again and probably multiple times because it is really a remarkable story. And the other story is a more recent story. It's a story of the cube in oil shale drilling. We touched on that last week, and I wanted to further discuss that this week. Okay, so let's start off with the story of the P-51 during World War II. Now, for those of you who like aviation museums, like I do, the Royal Air Force Museum in London is a rather remarkable place. And when you first enter that museum, what you see, as I have done when I was over there a few years ago, the first thing you see is a P-51 on a rotating pedestal. That's the first airplane that you see as soon as you enter the museum. Now, the museum has got lots and lots of airplanes, but the first one you see is a P-51 on a rotating pedestal. And why is that? Because if you had to identify a single factor that contributed to successfully defeating the Nazi menace during World War II, the P-51 was it. And the individual, not only was the P-51 instrumental in a big way to the Allied success in the European theater in World War II, but the individual who is also equally as responsible and ought to be well known. He is not, but he ought to be. So the P-51 and the individual who made it all happen was a guy by the name of Ronald Harker, H-A-R-K-E-R, Ronald Harker. And what he did, he was a test pilot, and what he did, he proposed installing a different engine in the early versions of the P-51. And this different engine was the Rolls-Royce Merlin 61 engine. It was kind of a new engine. It was not being utilized in other than the Lancaster bomber, but he proposed that they also install it in the P-51, replacing the original engine. And by doing so, using the same space that the original engine occupied, this new engine was able to increase the horsepower output from 1,200 to 1,600 horsepower. And the top speed of the aircraft then was able to be increased by a whopping 100 miles per hour. The service ceiling increased up to 42,000 feet, and the range, remarkably, the range increased to 1,650 miles. And the P-51 then was able, because of these remarkable performance characteristics, was able to save the U.S. bomber force operating in Europe, resulting in mission success. Bomber losses over Germany during that time, just prior to the introduction of the re-engined P-51, sometimes reached as high as 25%. As a result of that, the raids over Germany were suspended until they could figure out how to counter the German fighters that were being launched, that were attacking our bombers and shooting them down. The solution, of course, was to escort the American bomber fleet, and as well as the British bomber fleet, to escort those bombers with the new re-engined P-51, which they did, and they were able to be successful. And the war quickly came to an end because of that. Now you can say, okay, yeah, that's interesting history. What has that got to do with me today? Well, that really has everything to do with what I'm talking about today, because here you have an individual who is thinking outside the box, recognized that there was, in fact, a problem with the bomber fleet. Everything that they tried failed, and this individual, a single individual, came up with this idea to create a completely new weapons platform by swapping out an engine. The same cubic feet of space was being used, but the engine had some characteristics that were new, that were not readily available, but they were new, and it produced an airplane of exceptional performance, far exceeding anything else in the air at that time. So, can a individual achieve such dramatic success in the area of complex problem solving? And the answer is, of course, yes. And this is the history is full, completely full of these examples of how a single individual with this remarkable idea was able to achieve success beyond all expectations. Okay, now fast forward to today and what's going on today. Now, we talked a little bit about this last week. Another innovation that has just come about as a result of some individual or small group of people that are operating in the oil exploration business, all right? So the oil industry. Now, this is the story of what I call the cube in oil shale drilling, all right? What does exactly that mean? Again, we talked about this. We introduced this idea last week. I don't know if this company came up with this idea. I think that they did. There's a couple of exploration companies that are trying this out. But anyway, so I'm going to give, for the want of better information, I'm going to give this company credit. Name of the company is Encana, E-N-C-A-N-A, Encana. And their innovation is called the Cube. And what they do is that they drill multiple wells targeting multiple layers. So before they started this new innovative process, typically a single oil well captured or targeted a single layer in the oil shale area. Now, what Encana has decided to do is to rethink this whole thing and to drill two-dimensional space, but in a three-dimensional space. So consider the drilling area or the potential for oil-producing oil shale as existing in a three-dimensional space. And that's the idea behind the cube. And they have done so. And so what they do is that they take rather large platform and they drill multiple wells, hooking up their multiple pumps, and then they pump out oil from these drill areas in this closed, very close proximity to one another, except that the wells are not targeting the same layer. So you might have one well that is targeting layer A, and the next well right next to it is targeting B, and so forth and so on. And so you have a cube, if you will, and everything is in close proximity, which improves productivity and dramatically. And so this new innovation that has just come about is being used in the Permian oil field, and that's in South Texas, southwestern Texas, the Permian shale oil fields. And it's called the title of this thing that we're talking about is called the Permian's Mammoth Cubes. And cube development emerges in this particular area. So this company in Canada is producing these, has 19 wells within this small arena, and they are pumping 20,000 barrels of crude per day from these 19 wells, and that is a much higher production rate than other competing systems of oil extraction. And this is another innovation that has hit the marketplace, shows once again how innovation and creativity is, in fact, the fuel for our economic engine. That completes another Throttle Up radio show, and we will be with you again next week. Before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here, and I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.